Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Told in full for the first time, the new book Camelot's End, Kennedy versus Carter and the Fight That Broke the Democratic Party, is a narrative of Ted Kennedy and Jimmy Carter leading up to a brutal primary in 1980 that forever altered American politics. John Ward, a 20-plus year D.C. political journalist, has written the story, saying this was the last time a U.S. president received a serious challenge from inside his party, and the last all-out floor fight where politicians fought in real time to decide the nominee. Ward is a senior political correspondent for Yahoo News and has chronicled American politics and culture for two decades as a city desk reporter in Washington, D.C., and as a White House correspondent and as a national affairs correspondent. Again, the name of the new book is Camelot's End, and it's a great pleasure to welcome John Ward to this week's book show. John, thank you very much for being with us.
It's a privilege. Thank you for having me on.
I greatly appreciate it. What brought you to this time in history?
It was 6 years ago, actually, almost exactly. I was at a Democratic meeting in D.C. President Obama had just been reelected. Ted Kennedy had only been dead a couple years and was largely remembered as the lion of the Senate. And I started talking to a few people who were around during that campaign. They started reminiscing about this story where Jimmy Carter chased Ted Kennedy around the stage at the convention on national television, and Jimmy Carter was completely embarrassed and humiliated on national television. And I thought, you know what? I don't really know anything about that. What is that all about? How could that have happened? So I just started from there. I started talking to people. And what I quickly realized was that this story was not just sort of an interesting anecdote. It was a really epic battle between these two men. And it really also went to something that was at the heart of what divided Democrats that year, but also for a decade, because it wasn't for another 12 years that they were able to get back into the White House after the 80 election. And I thought this is a really interesting, kind of undertold, really not well-known story, because people want to talk about the winners of history. They're not as interested in talking about the losers, but this is a very, very fascinating, dramatic story. And so I started working on it then and had a couple kids along the way, and now here we are.
The idea of a senator, much less a senator with the name Kennedy, to run against an incumbent president, yes, embattled, but to run against an incumbent president. How much of that decision was the trouble that Ted Kennedy had running prior and the ultimate timing of it and the problem that he philosophically had with James Earl Carter?
He would have run probably before 1980 if it weren't for Chappaquiddick, which was, most of your listeners will probably be somewhat familiar with it, especially since there was just a film put out on this. But for those who don't know, Chappaquiddick happened in the summer of 69. Ted Kennedy disappeared from a party on Martha's Vineyard late one night with a young campaign worker from Bob Kennedy's presidential campaign. And the next morning, Ted's car was in the water in a channel. And this young worker, Mary Jo Kopechne, was in the car and dead. He took until the next morning, really, to report this to police, and probably should have gone to jail and lost his Senate seat, but was let off with a slap on the wrist. But he was not able to run for president in 1972 because of this, and then kind of felt like in 76, it was still too soon. And then in 80, really what kind of tempted him into doing this was that Carter's political prospects were so bad. His approval rating was worse than Richard Nixon's during the Watergate scandal. And so these kind of things combined, they saw an opening and they thought that it had been long enough since the Chappaquiddick scandal for Ted to run.
What were the signs for him, for Senator Kennedy, that it was a good time in the sense that he would have the support to unseat in a primary the incumbent president?
Well, most of the polling showed that Democrats wanted Kennedy 2-1, really, over Carter. So by the fall of 1979, the conventional wisdom really is that Carter's dead in the water and that Kennedy's going to be the Democratic nominee. That was really sort of the working assumption, because Carter's, really, the year of 1979 had been so terrible for Carter. And so that, you know, people just basically assumed Kennedy will be the nominee.
You write about halfway in the book that there was one speech that Jimmy Carter gave as president, and the performance that he gave that Kennedy felt was lackluster, that began his thought process of I can run and I can win.
Yeah, well, this is often known as the malaise speech. It happened in the summer of 1979, and it was in response to an energy crisis, which happened in part because of the radical revolution in Iran, where radicals seized control of the government. As the energy crisis unspooled over the summer of 79, you had gas lines, which if people were alive during then, they'll remember quite vividly. But these were, you know, hours-long lines. There was violence. Two people in Brooklyn were killed during this time. And then there was also a trucker's strike in response, partly again, to the energy crisis. There were people killed as a result of that. And so you had inflation. Joblessness was rising up. Inflation was so bad that the middle class really was making it hard for them to make large purchases of any kind on a home or a car. And so Carter was called back prematurely, really. He was abroad. He was supposed to spend a few days in Hawaii to kind of recover from a lot of travel. His people pulled him back. He was supposed to give a speech that would have sort of been a general, generic energy speech. But instead of doing that, disappears for, you know, 24 hours or so. People don't really know exactly where the president is. Turns out he's at Camp David. He spends 10 days there, has a summit, talks to all sorts of people. And when he comes back, he gives a speech and he calls on the nation to really rouse itself from not just an energy crisis, but what he diagnoses as a spiritual crisis. It's a really remarkable speech. And when he first gave it, it was actually really well received. And people did not call it the malaise speech then. And for a couple of days, his numbers really rallied up.
You do write about that. And at the end of 1978, he was seeing resurgent poll numbers by the end of the year. And that gave Senator Kennedy pause, and then things turned, and they turned rather quickly.
You're correct to note that at the end of 78, into 79, really, Carter is able in the first few months of 79 to finalize the peace talks that he had done at Camp David the previous year. And so 1979 starts off okay, but then the energy crisis happens. Carter gives this speech, and then what happens a few days after the speech is that he basically fires most of his cabinet, keeps a couple of them, but fires most of them. And this was largely on the advice of his chief of staff, Ham Jordan. And that was the result of research at the Carter Center that I don't think has ever been reported. There was a long memo from Ham Jordan telling him to fire most of the cabinet to show strength. But it came off really exactly the opposite, because he looked like he was panicking. He looked like he didn't know what he was doing. And so from that point on, really, that speech and that period of time became a black mark on Carter's record. After watching the speech, Kennedy did say, you know, you shouldn't blame the American people for the problems that we have. And so that was one of the big moments where he said, I think I'm going to run.
Journalist John Ward is our guest. The name of the book is Camelot's End, Kennedy versus Carter and the Fight That Broke the Democratic Party. The book is published by 12. When Kennedy decides to run, you point out, yes, there were issues to worry about, one of them being health care. But ultimately, Kennedy was looking at this as a difference in leadership. He did not see President Carter as an effective leader, and he thought he could do a much better job for the American people.
Yeah, and you have to really look at the different worlds that Jimmy Carter and Ted Kennedy came from. And it created two very different people. Two very different men, two very different kinds of leaders. And Carter, I guess the thing that Kennedy didn't like about his leadership style was that Carter was really sort of a diagnostic. He liked to get into the details of things. He liked to understand them. He was hyper-rational. And Kennedy was much more of a, you know, he'd been schooled in really the tradition of American leadership, grand rhetoric. His brother, JFK, obviously was the master of these, you know, soaring rhetorical speeches. Carter didn't really believe in a lot of what you would call magic, you know, which is a lot of what people, Democrats especially, loved about the Kennedys. Carter didn't really believe in, like, the intangibles. He just thought people should respond to reason. And so that was, I think, a big part of why Kennedy thought that Carter was not able to sort of summon the country to greatness, because he was too busy trying to diagnose problems and then give very specific solutions rather than speaking to something deeper in the country's psyche.
I remember the question at the time was this a campaign that Carter ran and did a good job in running the campaign, or it was because Kennedy did such a bad job? And I mean, you look at that in the book, and one of the things that is pointed to is an interview that Kennedy gives during the primary that, by all accounts, a disaster.
Yeah, it's known as the Mudd interview, or, you know, some people will refer to it as, you know, why do you want to be president? So this was an interview that Roger Mudd, who was at CBS News, had been trying to set up for a while. There were two interviews, which a lot of people don't know. The first one took place at Ted Kennedy's house on Cape Cod. A really interesting sort of side note, as maybe like a media angle, is that there were no staffers with Ted Kennedy at this interview. And Ted always maintained afterwards that he thought it was going to be like a puff piece interview. But for a good 30 minutes of airtime, so I'm not really sure, I think it was about an hour of taping, it turned out to be 30 minutes, this first interview alone, of just really tough questioning on Chappaquiddick. Over and over, questions about why he took the route that he took and everything else you could imagine. It's an hour-long special, the way that it aired, and by the time you got to the question that everybody remembers, which is, why do you want to be president, there had already been a full half hour of just brutal questioning of Kennedy by Mudd about Chappaquiddick. And Kennedy was really, really uncomfortable, clearly on camera, answering this. The why do you want to be president question took place at a second interview that Kennedy's people actually asked for to, you know, as a makeover, as a makeup. And so that question took place in his Senate office. And what people remember is that he kind of gave a bumbling answer that didn't say a whole lot, and it indicated that he didn't really know the answer to the question.
Roger Mudd, is, as you write in his introduction to this interview, says his coming candidacy seems almost seductive. The Irish charm and self-deprecating humor, the painful evocation of Jack and Bobby, the powerful pull of nostalgia, Mudd narrated. But there is more to Edward Kennedy than those familiar images, and for the next hour, we will report on the quality of character, his performance as a senator, and his conduct at Chappaquiddick. It seems to me two of those are really so linked, quality of character and his conduct at Chappaquiddick. Mm-hmm. And that's ultimately what is fine-tuned and looked at in microscopic detail.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole chapter on this interview, not just what happened in the interview, but what the negotiations were beforehand. The interesting thing about the timing, the Kennedy campaign tried to schedule their announcement of his candidacy before it could run, because that would then trigger an equal time requirement on Carter's part that they knew would make it hard for whatever program it was to actually run the thing. So the long story short, the Kennedy campaign engaged in subterfuge to try to undermine CBS from ever running this interview. It aired the same day on a Sunday night that the hostages were taken in Iran. Those two things, the taking of the hostages in Iran and the Mudd interview, were these twin blows to Kennedy's candidacy 3 days before he officially announced.
I find this, of course, I'm an interviewer, so I find this interesting. this whole Roger Mudd interview mm-hmm. is fascinating. You write that even on the question of a Kennedy curse, that Mudd had a provocative way of posing his questions, hoping to pry loose some new response, some measure of self-disclosure or self-reflection from the senator. And basically what Mudd does is throws it to Ted Kennedy, saying, there are people that believe that the greatest public service that you could perform would be not to run, so that you would save the country this trauma again. Wow.
Yeah, I ended up walking away from this, learning many things from doing this book. And one of them was that Roger Mudd probably should have been given the anchor's chair that Walter Cronkite vacated rather than Dan Rather.
Yes, agreed. It's eviscerating, and yet he perfectly sums up and collects the feelings of so many Americans.
Yeah, but at the same time, you have to remember, I mean, I would note that this is 1979, and the Democratic primary process had changed dramatically, you know, just 7 years before that. Up until the 68 convention and through that year, primaries were really controlled by the parties and the party bosses. But after the 68 convention in Chicago, they changed it and they opened it up. And so, you know, what the grassroots wanted by this time was much more influential. So the press reported it that way. And so that was a big part of why, even if a lot of the country maybe would have thought, don't run, even if maybe some of the party bosses might have thought that, there was grassroots energy for this, and that was powerful.
Again, the name of the book is Camelot's End. John Ward is our guest on this week's book show. The question about the impact that this has on Carter in the general election. So, yes, Jimmy Carter wins the primary, but he comes out being very battered and bruised by it. It's an impossible question to ask and to answer. You obviously look at it in great detail. But without that bruising primary, do you think the results could have been different in Jimmy Carter's run against Ronald Reagan?
Yeah, it's a hard question to answer. I think that Carter's hand that he was dealt was incredibly difficult. And I think that even without the bruising primary, the really difficult thing for Carter to overcome would have been the hostage crisis. Because while the taking of the hostages in Tehran did help rally the country to Carter initially, and that's what helped him in the primary against Kennedy, which is kind of counterintuitive if you haven't thought about this in a while. But it helps him at first, but then it drags on and it drags on. And when you look closely at the last weekend before the general election vote between Carter and Reagan, the polls, according to the Carter campaign, were fairly close, maybe even, you know, dead even. But there's a refocusing on the hostages in great detail over that last weekend. It's the year anniversary of their capture, and Pat Caddell, Carter's pollster, you know, starts to see the numbers go south in a big way that last weekend, and things, the bottom just falls out. And so I think when you look at it that way, it's hard to argue that Carter could have defeated Reagan even if he hadn't had the primary challenge. But Carter definitely feels like, you know, Kennedy challenging him had a lot to do with his loss, and he told me that much.
You talked to, you begin this in the introduction, but you got to talk to Jimmy Carter about this.
Yeah, I went to Atlanta and visited him at the Carter Center, and we spent about 30 or 40 minutes together.
Do you wish, of course, Senator Kennedy has passed, but do you wish you had had the same opportunity? Do you think anything would have changed in your reporting as a result of looking into his eyes and talking to him about that campaign?
I don't know that anything would have changed. I worked really hard to see this through each man's perspective, and I came away from the project feeling like both Carter and Kennedy are often caricatured and not fully appreciated. So I don't know that interviewing Kennedy would have changed a whole lot. I think it would have been interesting to ask him what he felt like he learned out of the process. I'm not sure he would have said a lot. He was kind of famously not super self-reflective.
Right.
So I don't know that he would have gone in for a lot of introspection.
You were not alive at the time of this campaign.
I was alive. I was born in 77.
Oh, you were born in 77. Well, but still, you don't probably remember anything, do you?
I was barely sentient, yes.
Yes. So I've got 10 years on you. And I mean, yeah. I remember so much of it because it was such a kind of a battle in the household. And huh. And I was just, I'm curious as to what does that have any bearing on your interest to the story? You know, I think so many of us who live through it remember it as, I mean, maybe this is me telling too much out of school, but my goodness, my mother, I very rarely saw my mother flustered, but she was not happy to see Ted Kennedy take on Jimmy Carter.
Interesting.
That did not go well in a Democratic household like ours.
Yeah. No, there's nothing like that in my background. My parents were actually, you know, fairly conservative. When I was growing up, my dad was a Carter voter in 76 and then voted for Reagan and has been a Republican voter pretty much since then. So there was none of that sort of baggage in our household. I really just came to it as somebody who thought, you know, what an incredible story that deserves to be told. And I think when you look at the fact that there's no mention at all at the Kennedy Institute, which is devoted to Ted Kennedy's life and career and the U.S. Senate, there's no mention there that he ever ran for president. I think it just adds to this conclusion I came to, which is that it's a great story. It's really crucial to understanding Ted Kennedy and how he became a respected line, you know, the line of the Senate, arguably one of the greatest lawmakers in American history. I think to understand how he got there, one of the key things you have to understand is how he got this monkey off his back of, he had to run for president at some point. There was just too much pressure on him to do so. And he finally got it done. You know, I think part of the reason he went all the way to the convention, kind of burned the bridges, was because he just wanted to get it over and done with somewhere deep in his psyche.
At the end of calendar year 1980, Ronald Reagan is elected president. Both Jimmy Carter and Ted Kennedy are losers. And yet, as you just indicated in regards to Ted Kennedy, Jimmy Carter since then, of course, has had an amazing political resurrection as well.
Yeah, he really has redefined what it means to be an ex-president. He created the Carter Center and the Carter Library. And, you know, there are things like that that presidents before him did, but nobody turned it into a humanitarian venture like he's done. He's, you know, mediated crises in hot spots across the globe. He's done elections oversight. He's done disease, you know, intervention in Africa, where he's almost completely stamped out the Guinea worm disease with the work of his group. So yeah, like Kennedy, I came away from this book deeply appreciative of who Jimmy Carter is and what he's done in his life. I think he's really miscast. One of my favorite anecdotes about Carter is that Hunter S. Thompson, the famous gonzo journalist, once said that, you know, Carter was one of the three meanest people he'd ever met, along with the founder of Hell's Angels and Muhammad Ali. You know, I guess you'll have to read the book to get a better sense of that. But he was such a determined and hardworking and sometimes ruthless politician.
Yeah, but I don't know, even in reading the book, I don't know if it comes off always as mean. Certainly determined, certainly driven. I don't mean, I guess, and also it's coming from Hunter S. Thompson.
Of course, yes. But I think there is a chapter called Mr. Mean where it gets into how Carter had this habit of basically rhetorical excess. And oftentimes he would sort of exaggerate his critiques of his opponents. And then he would also make comments that were sort of unnecessarily personal. I think part of that stemmed from one of his weaknesses, which was he was kind of a self-righteous scold. He didn't do well with people that he thought were sort of morally suspect.
The name of the book is Camelot's End, Kennedy versus Carter and the Fight That Broke the Democratic Party. The book is published by 12. John Ward, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me on. Appreciate it very much.
John Ward's new book is Camelot's End, Kennedy versus Carter and the Fight That Broke the Democratic Party. It is published by 12. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.